Chapter 24. North of the Border. Most of the 10 or 12 provincial Buddhist groups were situated in the southern part of Britain, and so far my pastoral excursions had carried me no further north than Newcastle, whose chairman, the bluff, rationalistic Bill Halford, had introduced himself to me at my first summer school and invited me to pay them a visit. The visit did not take place until the following April. Having travelled up by the Flying Scotsman and caught a glimpse of York Minster and of Durham Cathedral and Castle on the way, I was met at the station by Bill and by him driven some miles out of town to a small lake in the moors, known, so he informed me, as the Duck Pond. The trip served a double purpose. It enabled my host to tell me about the book he was writing about Newcastle Buddhist affairs. The group had 8 or 9 regular members, all men. And what he thought of Ananda Bodhi, about whom he was not very complimentary. As well as to show me the moors, of which he seemed rather proud, but which, seen through a thin veil of rain beneath a leaden sky, to me appeared bleak and desolate in the extreme. In the evening I gave personal interviews to members and friends and conducted a meditation session at the Quaker meeting house where the Newcastle group usually met. Bill and the others then escorted me to the station where I caught the Pullman back to London after what, according to my diary, had been a very worthwhile visit. As I settled into my little compartment, I could not help thinking how comfortable and convenient the sleeping arrangements were, especially when compared to the conditions under which I had been accustomed to travel in India. Since that visit to the Newcastle group, I had penetrated no further north than Biddulph. Later in the year, however, I received an invitation from Glasgow. The invitation came not from a Buddhist group, at that time there was no Buddhist group in Glasgow, but from Glasgow University, as represented by its lecturer in the philosophy of religion, the Reverend E. H. Pyle. Glasgow being the second biggest city in Great Britain, and its university an old and distinguished one, naturally I was happy to accept, and after a further exchange of letters, it was agreed that my visit should take place during the first week of December. At 10 o'clock one Sunday morning, I accordingly left for Glasgow from Euston, Terry accompanying me. Luckily, we had the compartment to ourselves so that we could talk freely, and I was able to work on my lecture notes while my friend either read or dozed. Terry was visiting Scotland for the first time, but I had been there once before. It was from Glasgow that, 20 years earlier, I had embarked for India, and I had vivid memories of the docks, of the crowded quayside, and of how my khaki-clad comrades and I had filed up the gangway into the bowels of the enormous grey troopship, without knowing where we were really going, or how long we would be away. At Queen Street Station, Terry and I were met by Ernest Pyle, a short, balding man of about my own age, and an Indian student who was the president of the International Society. Our train having arrived 2 hours late, they took us straight to the university and straight to the meeting room, where, after a cup of coffee, I addressed the members of the International Society on the Buddhist Way. I explained that way in terms of the 12 positive nidanas, beginning with independence upon suffering arises faith, and concluding with independence upon liberation arises knowledge of the destruction of the defilements. Not that I plunged straight into my subject. After giving an outline of the Buddha's early life and describing his attainment of enlightenment, I explained how that enlightenment or vision of reality found conceptual expression for purposes of communication in the principle of conditionality, and how conditionality itself was of two kinds, cyclical and spiral, or reactive and creative, and how the Buddhist way was based on the second kind of conditionality. Only when I had prepared the ground in this manner did I launch into an extended account of each of the positive nidanas in turn. The lecture was attended by 170 students of all nationalities, and I was given an enthusiastic reception. Many questions were asked, and there was much vigorous discussion. The following afternoon, I addressed a much smaller gathering, consisting mainly of Ernest Pyle's own students, on the topic of the nature and development of Buddhism. As I wanted to leave plenty of time for discussion, this lecture was shorter than the previous one, besides being more technical and less systematic. In it, I dealt initially with various questions of interpretation, as I called them. Shilavrata Paramarsha, the third of the 10 fetters binding to mundane existence, was not dependence on rites and ceremonies, which was the usual translation, but attachment to moral rules and religious observances as ends in themselves. Nor had the Buddha borrowed this or that idea from his Upanishadic predecessors or from popular Indian religion, as alleged by some scholars. He had simply used the language of his time and place to communicate his own unique vision, and in doing so had given a new meaning to such key terms as Brahmana and Vasala. This led me to explore the nature of the relation between a founded or universal religion like Christianity, Buddhism and Islam, and an ethnic religion like Judaism and Hinduism, and this in turn to what I call the phenomenology of Buddhism. That is to say, the fact that its history comprised the three great phases of development, known respectively as the Hinayana, the Mahayana, and the Vajrayana. Having briefly characterized each of these phases, I address myself to the question of the supposed deification of the Buddha in the Mahayana, insisting that the Buddha was neither God nor man. He belonged to a third category, for which there was no equivalent in Western thought, that of enlightened man. In conclusion, I reminded my hearers that we should be careful how we applied Western categories to Eastern religions, a point that was well taken and one which, in particular, gave rise to a number of questions in the lively and prolonged discussion that followed. The actual giving of my two lectures occupied only a fraction of the time Terry and I spent in Glasgow, but thanks to Ernest Pyle, our programme nonetheless was a full one. On the Monday morning, he came to the university guest house where we had spent the night and took us on a sightseeing trip into the city centre. We went by bus, I noted in my diary that evening. Everything very grim and grimy, Victorian Gothic. Not so cold as had expected. After visiting a second-hand bookshop, where I bought a nice edition of Bishop Butler's works, in two volumes bound as one, we went to see the River Clyde, on whose dull, polluted waters we gazed down from an iron bridge, in which I thought, in the words of my diary, quite picturesque. At one point we bumped into our guide's teenage son. Down the side of the youngster's face ran the scarlet line of a recently healed wound. He'd been standing outside a cinema one evening, his father explained, when someone had suddenly appeared out of the darkness and slashed his cheek with a razor. The notorious razor gangs were, it seemed, still operating in Glasgow. Back at the university, we took coffee with the Professor of Divinity and the university chaplain, lunched with Ernest Pyle and the young lecturer in logic, met the Professor of Zoology and his wife, and saw the university library. We then had tea with our host in his study, where a number of people came to see me, including the chaplain for overseas Buddhists, and where we were kept talking until it was time for me to give my second lecture. After the lecture and the ensuing discussion, Ernest Pyle took us round to his own place for tea, and from there, after more talk, to the station and the Pullman in which we were to travel back to London that night. It had been an interesting visit, and we had much to talk about, and indeed reflect upon. My visits to Oxford and Cambridge had been at the invitation of their respective Buddhist societies, which were student organisations, so that my contacts within those twin seats of learning were largely confined to that tiny section of the undergraduate population, which, for various reasons and in varying degrees, was attracted to Buddhism. In the case of Glasgow, my visit took place at the invitation of the university itself, and I addressed not only one of the bigger student organisations, but Ernest Pyle's class in the philosophy of religion. I also had the opportunity of getting to know Ernest Pyle himself, and of meeting, through his good offices, representatives of some of the university's different faculties. Thus, although my visit to Glasgow was a short one, I had there a range of contacts that was wider, intellectually speaking, than I had at either Oxford or Cambridge, or than was available to me at the Hampstead Vihara and the Buddhist Society. My exchanges with representatives of the various disciplines, from divinity to zoology, limited as those exchanges may have been, in fact, gave me a better understanding of the nature of the challenge to which Buddhism in Britain would have to rise if it was to exert a real influence on the spiritual and intellectual life of the nation. Perhaps new ways of presenting the Dharma would have to be found. We might even be able to learn something from other spiritual groups. Only the previous month, Terry and I had investigated an Uspensky group with this possibility in mind. The group met in a hired room in Victoria, in the shadow, so to speak, of the Buddhist Society. Including the speaker, there were four people present besides ourselves, and the talk, which was devoted to Uspensky's teachings, was the poorest I had heard since leaving India. It was certainly poorer than any I had heard at the speaker's class, and Terry and I did not bother to visit the group again. We did not visit Glasgow again either. In the following decade, I was to visit it many times on my own, though Ernest Pyle and I continued to correspond. The correspondence came to an end only some years later, when the friendly, broad-minded Congregational minister transported himself and his family to the other side of the globe and took up a teaching appointment at an Australian university.